right, take two. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the 2015 4th of July in the Park meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. My name is Deanna, and I'm a 100-pounder and a compulsive overeater. Hi. Well, those who wish to, please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right. Whatever problem you may have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Are there any compulsive eaters here besides myself? All right, you're in the right park. The following is the OA preamble. Overeaters Anonymous is a fellowship of individuals who, through shared experience, strength, and hope, are recovering from compulsive overeating. We welcome everyone who wants to stop eating compulsively. There are no dues or fees for members. We are self-supporting through our own contributions, neither soliciting nor accepting outside donations. OA is not affiliated with any public or private organization, political movement, ideology, or religious doctrine. We take no position on outside issues. Our primary purpose is to abstain from compulsive overeating and carry the message of recovery through the 12 steps of OA to those who still suffer. I have asked Renee to read How It Works from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous.
I am Renee, compulsive overeater. How It Works, from Chapter 5 of Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book of AA. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with food, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. There is one who has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Can you guys do them with me? By heart. One, we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to recovery. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people except with to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guidelines to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after made clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were compulsive overeaters and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our compulsion. And C, that God...
Thank you. Thanks, Renee. All right, now it is time for some oratory fireworks to get you started. We're going to bring up our speakers. Our first speaker is Shivangi. And in honor of the 4th of July, each speaker, if you could, share your experience, strength, and hope with a little emphasis or a lot on your reliance on your higher power in the program of Overeaters Anonymous. So we're going to go ahead and bring Shivangi up.
Hi, I'm Shivangi. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi,
Shivangi. Hi, Sienna. Thank you so much for asking me to speak. I definitely had, like, I was sitting this morning and thinking, okay, what am I going to say? And a couple of things ran through my head that I kind of want to share. One is, like, 100% ego. I'm like, oh, yeah, you're going to be, you were asked to speak at this big thing. Oh, sorry. You were asked to speak at this, like, big event, and everyone's going to, I love being center of attention, and, like, I'm just being honest, you know. And then I was like, no, you know, that's not the point of this, though. That's not the point of this. Like, the point of anyone speaking, because it could be anyone, right? Anyone could come up and speak and share their story and their experience with, you know, a spiritual transformation and faith, and that's what we need to hear over and over and over. And so that's all I'm here to do. So I'm privileged, and thank you so much. And then the other thing I was thinking about was when I led my first meeting, like about a year ago, because I'm fairly newer to program than a lot of you guys. The whole lead was about all the terrible things that had happened to me before I came into program, you know. And I mean, that's okay, because that's what seemed like the right thing to share then. But I was like just reflecting on that this morning, and I'm like, oh my God, it's just not my story anymore, you know. Like, my whole story has changed. It's not about being a victim of all these terrible circumstances anymore. It's about hope and a loving community and a loving higher power. And I just feel I'm so grateful for the transformations. So I'll start with, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. As far as what it was like, I grew up in a very loving family. They were doing their best. It was dysfunctional, but I feel like every family's got to be dysfunctional, right? I don't know. My dad definitely had, like, rage issues, and there definitely was kind of like an Al-Anon sort of dynamic in our house, you know, because of that probably. But, you know, that's okay, and I think they really were doing their best, and they didn't have the leisure that I've had to, like, explore their own thoughts and feelings. They were, you know, working day and night trying to support us and their extended families, and so, but I had a loving family, and I had always, you know, clothes, and we went on nice vacations, and it was just fine, you know, it was a fine upbringing. But I turned to food early. I really, really, really liked eating. And food is a big thing in my family. It must be a little bit cultural, but my dad is, like, obsessed with food. And he's not an overeater. but he talks about it constantly. And it makes it kind of hard to go home sometimes because he'll be like, oh, you're coming home? Okay, what do you want to eat? We could have this, or we could have this, or we could have this. And, like, they've even, like, worked around my abstinence requirements and, like, found ways to, like, still make those delicious things without white flour. And I'm like, no, don't do that. Like, the point is not to, like, manipulate the food so I can still eat the stuff that triggers me. No, the point is, like, just to let that go, that is not the source of joy in my life anymore, you know? But I appreciate, I mean, this is how he shows his love. And he kind of knows about Pargo. He doesn't really get it. But they know that my life has changed, and they've seen the transformation inside and out. So they're very, very happy about that. So, I mean, as I went through, and I think also I was clinically depressed as a child and as a teen and definitely into adulthood, and I needed to seek outside help for it, and I think that that's fine. I need program and the outside help, and that makes life really good right now. So, so it was hard, and so I was feeling down. The reason I share that is that I was really, really going through hard times, and a lot of difficult things happened, too. Things that sort of made me, you know, turn to food increasingly. It's a progressive disease, right? So more and more and more over the years, I would turn to food, and then I'd do these, like, crash diets where I, like, wouldn't eat anything but vegetables for 3 months, you know, and I'd lose, like, 50 pounds. I mean, that's just so – and then I was, like, when I did that diet, I was, like, oh, this is it. I found the secret. I can do this forever, you know? And, like, and you get so much external validation when you lose weight so quickly. Everyone's, like, wow, you did such a good job. If there's one thing I love more than food, it's compliments, you know? So it's like, I was like, oh, I can do this forever, you know? And, but, you know, I couldn't. I stopped, and I gained the weight back, you know, because when life got hard, food was the thing I knew best, how to comfort myself, you know? Basically, about 6 or 7 years ago, I heard about OA, and I was like, OA, what is this, you know? I was researching 12-step programs or something else altogether, something work-related. And I went on the OA website, and I read the questions, like, on the, you know, are you an overeater? Should you be part of OA? And I answered every single one of them, yes. And I was horrified, you know? It was like, do you plan your binges? Like, just plan out in your head, thank you, what you're going to have on your way home or whatever, and, like, plan out your grocery shopping based around your binges or whatever. And it's just like, it just described me to a T, basically. And it was eye-opening and horrifying. And then I just, like, didn't do anything about it. I told one person, I was like, I think I have a problem. And she's like, oh, okay. And then that's it. We didn't talk about it again for, like, 5 years, you know? I tried to go to a meeting, the one in Palms Park. I was so scared. I pulled into the parking lot. This was, like, maybe 4 years ago. And then I sat there, and I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm, like, crying. And then I go up to the front door, and I go to the guy, and I'm like, I'm here for overeaters. And he's like, oh. And he just was so nonchalant about it, and I just couldn't deal. I just left. I, like, didn't even go. It was so sad, you know. And now I love that Palms Park meeting. It's wonderful. And so, anyway, it took a lot for me to get in here, and I think what it really took was I found out I was diabetic about 3 years ago, and my top weight was about 220 pounds, and I don't know how much I weigh now. I don't weigh myself anymore because it's really, really triggering to me. I found out I was diabetic, and I had had, like, weight-related health issues before, and that's when I did that all-vegetable diet, and I vowed that I would never, ever, ever gain the weight back because it was so scary to go through health issues related to your weight. And lo and behold, like, a few years later, I found out I was diabetic, and I knew it was related to my weight. And I was also horrified because I knew about diabetes. I'm in the healthcare profession. I, like, was terrified by it. I thought it was the scariest thing ever and really such a calamity. And really, it's turned out to be the best thing that ever happened. I can't even say that enough. But I didn't join program when I found out I was diabetic. I waited 6 months. I tried to do the all vegetables again. It totally didn't work. It lasted for like 2 days. And then I ordered like a whole pizza and ate it. You know, and it's just, I you know, you can't. With the disease, it's strong, you know, and without God's help, and really for me, without the help of program, I can't manage it. I just can't. So I think that's when I had like 4 or 5 more months of really severe overeating, I was like, okay, you know what? I am destroying myself. Just cell by cell, I am just destroying my body,
I can't do this anymore. Like, what? I need help. And I was just, it was like the last house on the block. I just was so desperate. And so I'm grateful that when I came into the rooms, I was so super desperate, and I was just willing to do whatever you guys said, like anything. You know, I met my sponsor at my first meeting, and she started sponsoring me a few weeks later. And she was really, really strict with me. Like, she's so nice and loving, but she's very firm. And I was really resistant to that because I don't like people telling me what to do. You know, I think I know best. But I was desperate enough that I listened to her. And so everything she told me to do, there was always resistance starting out. So she told me, well, you need to get a nutritionist approved food plan or I won't sponsor you. I was like, nutritionist? I know about nutrition, you know, and then I'm like, but obviously I don't, you know, and obviously I need someone to tell me how to do this because I didn't do it very well on my own, right? I went to the nutritionist and I like complained about her afterwards. I'm like, I don't like her and she's like this and she's like that, but you know, I had to just get over it. And her food plan has been great. It served me really well actually for the last 2 years, so I'm really happy about that. My sponsor told me to consider taking, white flour out of my life. She just, you know, she's like, you should think about it, just based on my, like, red light foods and stuff. And I was like, I don't need to do that. I can do everything in moderation. And, like, I can't. I mean, again, at that time in this program, I don't do anything in moderation, not just food-related, like, anything in life before program. So she told me to take it out of my life, and I was like, she suggested it, and I was like, no, I don't need that. And then a few months passed, and it was, so I came into the rooms around, May, on Memorial Day, actually, in 2013, and I became abstinent, July 14th of 2013, so God willing, in 10 days, I'll have 2 years of continuous abstinence. And I say God willing because I'm, oh, thank you. But I really am always a bite away. I'm always, always just one bite away from total disaster, calamity, pandemonium, just relapse, you know. And I really try never to forget that. So about 6 months into my abstinence, it was New Year's, and I was planning this, like, New Year's dinner with my friends, and there was this pasta that was, I shouldn't talk about specific foods, I'm sorry. There was this dish at the restaurant I was going to, and I really wanted it. And so I had my nutritionist approved food plan, and this did not fit into my nutritionist approved, you know, food plan. But I was turning my food over to my sponsor every night, thank you, before I'd go to bed. And it was the food for the next day. That's another thing. She asked me to do that, and I'm like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to tell someone what I'm going to eat, and then, like, I have to stick with that? Like, that's crazy, you know? And now I'm like, oh, my God, that's the best thing ever. Like, if I don't, if I fall asleep without sending that email the next morning, I'm like, there's, like, all this, like, noise in my head. Well, what could I eat? I could have this. I could have that. And I don't need that anymore. I don't need that. That was my whole life, and it was miserable, you know? So I really appreciate her asking me to do that. So I was turning over my food that day, and I was like, okay, and then tomorrow night, I'm going to have one appetizer, one main course, and, you know, fruit. And she was like, can you be more specific? And I'm like, you know, and then I knew what she was going to say. If I told her it was like a giant bowl of something I shouldn't probably be eating, I knew what she was going to say. And for like the 24 hours before that New Year's dinner, I was obsessing. I kept looking at my phone and thinking of, like, well, how can I manipulate the words so that she doesn't know what it is? And, like, how can I, like, say it but not say it, you know? And it just, I was, like, crying on my way home from work. I mean, I was so out of control. And I called her and left her this crazy message. And she texted me back, and she was like, take a deep breath. This is what unmanageable feels like. And I was like, oh, my God. You know, I went to that dinner. I had fish and vegetables. It was fine. And the next day, I was like, I'm taking white flour off of my foods. I can't do it because it makes me crazy. And honestly, I haven't missed it. Not really. Like, the pros and, you know, the cons outweigh the pros with that stuff for me, you know. And I took out white rice at the time, too, because I kind of had a problem with that, too. So my abstinence is 3 meals a day, 2 optional snacks, no white flour and no white rice. I try to not eat recreational sugar just one day at a time. I feel like grapes and cherries are basically candy, so I don't really feel like I need the recreational sugar. I try to just follow a routine every day. I wake up in the morning, I get on my knees,
My morning routine has changed and evolved, and I suspect that that's probably true for a lot of people. Currently, I'm getting on my knees, and I'm reading in the first person the third step part of the big book and how it works, and it really helps. It really, really helps because, and this is the reliance on the higher power, I guess, it's just such a huge reminder every morning. It gets me into that space where I'm like, I am not running the show. I don't even want to. I don't want to, you know? Like, there's this amazing, amazing higher power who's just got me, and it's a lady. So I always say her. When I used to hear people say that, I was like, you know, I was a little bit, like, I grew up in a traditional religious household, and I wasn't sure how I felt about people, you know, whatever. But you know what? I've realized, like, in this program, the beauty of this program is that you choose your higher power. It doesn't have to be something that someone else made up. It's just what works for you, because that's the whole thing. The higher power works. Life without the higher power doesn't work. So, yeah, when I get on my knees every morning, I read that out loud, and I'm like, she's got me in her arms. Like, I don't have to do anything. You know, like, she is the principal. I'm her agent. She's the mother. I'm her child. And that's just so... It's just the best feeling every morning, reading that out loud and just knowing that that's true and that I can do anything. I just have to stay close to God, do God's will, and everything will turn out beautifully just as it should. Even if it doesn't feel beautiful to me at the time that it's happening, it's what's right for me as long as I'm staying close to God's will, you know? Okay, so I wrote down a couple of things. Oh, yeah. Okay, well, first of all, so then, you know, I usually try to read from a daily reader, do a little bit of meditation in the morning. I try to make my outreach calls either on the way to work or on the way back. A huge part of my story is definitely incremental willingness. I was not willing to make outreach calls at first. I was like, this is crazy. I don't know these people. I'm like, what are we going to talk about? It's so awkward. And how do you, like, end the conversation when it's like, yeah, it's all about the awkward. I was just trying to avoid any kind of human interaction. And then, you know, over time, I got the willingness, and it's become actually the best thing. One of the best parts of my program is just connecting with these just beautiful people that I've met, and especially just beautiful, like, just, it's forming a loving community of beautiful women, especially, you know, I'm so blessed. I mean, that's God working in my life for sure. So I make my outreach calls, I try to exercise every day, and then when I get home, you know, I email my sponsor every night, and I do like a mini 10 step, and I send her what I'm going to eat the next day, and it's very freeing, and I love it. As far as step work, so my sponsor has a way of doing step work that was, like, pretty intense. It's writing for 10 minutes every day, from one sentence of the way to I resist everything she tells me to do, and you know, but it's been incredible. It's been an incredible transformation. So, you know, 2 years into program, I'm on my fourth step now, and you know, sometimes I'm like, am I just like a dunce at program? Like, am I flunking program? You know, but it doesn't matter. That's not how it works. First of all, everyone goes at their own pace. Secondly, that way of doing step work has been incredible. It's really sunk in, you know? Like, I feel those steps every morning, and I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful to my sponsor and just the program for giving me that peace of mind and really letting me rely, when I can remember, on a higher power that just takes care of me constantly. So, let's see. Okay, yes. One thing I realized recently is that I'm coming up on 2 years, God willing, and I was like, oh, so I'm a toddler. I'm like a toddler in program. And there's been so many miracles already. And it's been so good already. And then I see people who have been in program for so many years, have been abstinent for so many years. And, you know, we still, I'm sure, all struggle with our daily ups and downs. But I'm just so excited that life can just keep being this good if I, again, stay close to God, follow God's will, and follow my program and my sponsor guidance. And I feel like it'll just get better and better. Because if I'm just like a baby right now still, you know, like, imagine what it's going to be like when I'm like an adult in program, you know, potentially. Who knows? Again, if that's God's will, I'd be so happy to get to that place. So I thought that was pretty cool. And then I was just thinking about, like, other miracles, like just miracles that I see in my life, you know. Like, I show up to things. I don't flake on people anymore. I show up to work early. I mean, it's crazy, you know. I pack my lunch. I go grocery shopping, and I buy healthy foods and prepare them. Like, I would never have done this stuff. I was so above it. I'm like, oh, I don't have time for that. And, you know, I have loving relationships with my family members and my friends, and I set my boundaries, and they listen, and they love me still, you know. And I, you know, finding romance and love and relationship has always been, like, part of my victim story, honestly. And I don't have that feeling anymore. And that's the biggest miracle, because that was the biggest wound I thought could never be healed, my, like, real feeling that I'm never going to find love, and I'm just, you know, I'm so exceptionally bad and whatever. And, you know, I had lots of sort of bad feelings about my history with, you know, romance and men and sex and stuff like that. But you know what? Like, I think as a result of this program, I've been able to just put that stuff aside and be like, you know, I'm fine. I'm fine. If it's going to come into my life, it'll come into my life. But I have a full life, and it will. You know, we're humans. We want to love each other. That's what we want to do, right? And love is already coming into my life in so many different ways. But I'm not exceptional. I'm not better or worse than anybody. And if that's something that humanly happens, that people couple up, then I will too. And it's fine, you know. And it just feels good. It feels good to have such a, like, a kind of sensible view now, you know. And that's a miracle, though. Huge, huge miracle. A miracle is that my trainer the other day, who I've worked with for years and we're very close, she was like, gosh, you know, your arms are toned, your legs are toned, but this area in the middle just drives me crazy. And I was like, oh, okay. And what I would have done before program, I would have not said anything, laughed it off, really taken it to heart, probably not even realized how much it bothered me, and then gone home and eaten and eaten and eaten. And what I did instead is I was like, you know what? I actually really am trying to love my body just the way it is right now. And, you know, and she was like, oh, yeah. And, you know, it sort of, I think, opened her eyes a little bit too. But I really genuinely didn't feel resentful towards her. I'm like, that's what she thinks. That's fine. You know, but this is, I'm just the way I am. Like, this poundage, it served me well at some point. I needed it. I needed it to survive. And so, in a weird way, I'm grateful to my stomach fat, you know, like, and so, yeah, that's definitely, there's so many miracles in this program, and I'll wrap up. I'm so grateful. Thank you again, Deanna, and just to all of you. This program is the best thing that's ever happened in my life. I cannot believe it. Every single day, I'm so lucky, and I can't wait to hear all of you share. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Shivangi. All right. Now we're going to bring up our speaker, Stephanie. Could you come on up, please?
Hi. I'm Stephanie. I'm a recovered bulimic compulsive overeater.
Stephanie, we're recording. Oh. This is the recording. Stay right here. Sorry about that.
Standing still. Okay. I'm going to try to make that work. No, 10.
10, 5, and 5. Okay, and I'm going to project, so.
So, I've been in program for, I want to say, around 27 years. Tell me what that is. Okay. Let me know if at some point you can't hear me. So, I'm going to tell my story. I definitely belong here. I had a period when I tried to leave. I left. It was very unsuccessful. So I'm back. I've been back and very committed for the last 10 years. I started program about 27 years ago. And by start, I mean I walked in and out and in and out and sat in the back of the room and listened and cried and left. But I'm going to get to that. So I grew up in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, the youngest of three girls. I lived under the poverty line. We had a house full of books, not a lot of food. I don't understand that. That's how it happened. I had a very strong, independent mother.
There were no men around. And the only time that I could ever, like, assert myself was at the dinner table. My mother could not cook, which, if you watch movies, if you, like, you know, hear stories of black people, everyone can cook. Like, that's just, like, a thing. It's a thing. But in my house, my mother could not cook. I didn't understand that vegetables didn't come out of a can until I was older, or that chicken should not be pink on the inside, red, not quite fully cooked. So I grew up with a lot of hunger issues because I refused to eat my mother's cooking, which it just every night it was a war at the dinner table. It was me falling asleep face down in something that resembled food and her demanding I eat and not being able to go to bed. Like, this just went on and on and on. And it was the only way that I could assert myself. And I refused to eat. And then I got older, and I was smart, so I was able to make friends with parents and people who could cook. There were a lot of other black people who could cook, and I knew them all. And I would get myself invited to lunch, to dinner. Like, you know, I ate lunch at school, breakfast at school. But basically, I grew up not having my emotional needs met. I mean, it's like, I grew up before the age of Oprah, so that wasn't a conversation. It wasn't like, oh, what are your needs today? You know, it was like, shut up, do your work, what are you upset about? I'm the one who works, I'm the one who has a hard life, you know, you're just supposed to be a kid. And those were the days when kids were supposed to be seen and not heard, and God forbid you complain. Not like today. So my mother grew up in an orphanage, a Catholic orphanage, and when she was older, she basically called her family together. And so by the time I came along and I had two older sisters, we had this makeshift family of all her siblings who she knew but didn't grow up with. And so, and I had a father who I did not know for the longest time. But he had a sister who I know. Black geography, that's also a thing. So I knew my aunt, but I didn't know she was my aunt. And when I was 12, I met my father, who was completely not blue collar, who informed me that he would be available as long as I didn't need anything from him. So that didn't help. And then when I was 12, I had the one uncle who was like the God in my family because he was very successful. And he was my mother's younger brother, and he was divorced, and he was like the perfect father figure until he raped me one night, which changed the course of my entire trajectory and shifted my relationship with food. So I talk about this a lot because I really feel like I know where my eating disorder came from. And it came from not having a voice, not being able to speak, and not, and just having like a sadness and a loneliness and a need for something that I could not put my fingers on. I just like, I didn't grow up hugged, you know, it sounds so cliche, but it's like I needed physical contact. I needed to hear and to know, and I needed someone to say, I love you, and to actually treat me that way. So after that experience with my uncle, which never happened again, it made me like a very hostile person in his presence. I shut down, and I decided that, like, people weren't safe. My family wasn't safe. I didn't call my mother, and not because she wouldn't believe me. She would have believed me, and she would have killed them, and then I would have been an orphan. And so I protected her, and that was my way of protecting her. Fast forward to my early 20s, I, you know, dieted, exercised, slim fast, like whatever the diet thing was, I did. I've never been overweight in my life. It
wasn't about weight for me. It was about control. I needed something I could control. And that seemed to be a good idea. I had a sister who did drugs. That just seemed ugly to me. I don't know. I didn't want to do drugs. And then I lived in a neighborhood in Brooklyn where I saw women drink a lot, and so that wasn't really appealing either. And what I loved, just I can admit this, what I loved about bulimia, which is what I discovered as like this fantastic thing that kind of quelled my anxiety, and at the same time, it was a secret. Like, I liked the secret part, and I liked that I had like a double secret because I was black. I just got like a pass. People were like, "Oh my God, you can just eat whatever you want. How do you stay so small?" Oh, like, it never occurred to anybody that like I was eating and throwing up, eating and throwing up. To the point where I thought I was really fooling like the whole universe. So I would do things like date, and I'd have a date. And then I have a second date, and then I have a third date at the exact same restaurant. Same waiter. Eat a full meal, throw up, because I knew where all the single bathrooms were from here to London. I could, like, tell you. Yeah, that was clean, that was not. Like, in my head, I knew. So I picked my restaurants for two reasons, the bread and the bathroom. And I thought I was, like, really sane. Just so you know. And I thought it was just this little behavior thing that I kind of had under control. I was batshit. I was like, I was insane. Like, my life revolved around waking up, going to the gym. No, running to the gym. I became friends with the trainer. I knew all the gym teachers. We had nothing in common, but I knew them all. They were all my friends. And then I would run home from the gym, stop at a mini mart and a donut shop and something else, get home, binge for like 3 or 4 hours. Oh, what's wrong with me? I gotta stop this. So everything in the dumpster in the back of my apartment building on Laurel Canyon in Hollywood. I just will never forget that location. And then I'd be calm for like 30 minutes, eat a carrot, and be off again. And then I'd go for like a 2-hour run. I know I had a job because I had to support myself, but I'm telling you, it was like spacey. I was insane. And then I remember being home and watching this TV movie, and it said something about bulimia, and it was like some movie about bulimia, and I was like, oh, what? Like, it's a thing? So it was a thing, and it mentioned OA, and so I went to a couple of OA meetings on Santa Monica Boulevard and Robertson, Monday night, never forget, sat in the back. And then I decided, you know, I don't know, I'm kind of okay. So I packed up all my lovely stuff and decided that it would be great for me to move back to the origin of the crime, so I went back to New York City. And I lived with my sister and helped take care of my niece, and I was like, I'm just going to find myself. And my older niece told my sister one day that I was throwing up every day. Kids. And so my sister came to me and she's like, I'm worried about you. I hear you've been throwing up. What's going on? The last thing I wanted was to stop throwing up at this moment. So then I said, it's because I was raped. It's because I was raped. I was raped when I was 12. And it's just been traumatic for me to not tell anyone. I would have rather everyone know that I was raped than to give up eating, like, and binging and throwing up. And then it just continued. I remember being on a subway and looking in the back of the Village Voice, and it said, you know, if you are throwing up and you can't stop, we can help you. I just wanted a magic pill. Like, forget the program. I needed a magic pill. So I went to some eating disorder clinic at some hospital, and they gave me some placebo, and they, like, met with me every week. And I could tell that I was, like, the purple giraffe, you know, because I was, like, the black girl in the 80s with the eating disorder. And, you know, all these doctors and residents and, like, researchers would come in and they'd crowd around the door. And I wanted to, and you know, I was hostile, kind of. And I was like, yeah, I, you know, fried chicken and watermelon, I'm just throwing it up. I had such a sense of humor about my insanity. That really didn't work. So I came back to L.A., and I crawled into the program. I crawled into meetings, and I was like, okay, I guess I have a problem. I can't say that in the back of my mind I wasn't still looking for, like, that door. Like, because maybe. You know, and the other thing is, I remember, like, telling people in my life, oh, I'm going, like, a few people, because there was a lot of shame involved with going into a room with a bunch of white people to talk about my black problems. Like, that's how it went. Like, there was no, like, we were segregated in my mind. Like, I didn't understand how going into a room full of people who didn't look like me, and a lot of people had BMWs, which, I don't know, that was, like, my thing. I was like, if you're rich, that's what you drive. And, you know, if you're privileged, that's what, and I used to always think, if I had enough money, then I wouldn't have any problems. This is what happens when you grow up under the poverty line. You have to choose a God, and mine was money. I was like, if I have enough money, I'm going to be perfect. And I go in this room, and I meet these women, and I start to hear their stories. And a lot of them have money. And they're like, they got this thing. And they can't stop either. And then I hear people who do have recovery. And I start to understand it's an inside issue. So bizarre to me. Like I just thought, if I had, you know, if someone loved me the way I deserve to be loved, like my longs, like deserved, like deeply, passionately, eternally, like, obsessively, then I wouldn't have an eating disorder. I got rid of him just because that didn't work. And I was just, like, really sad. Like, I realized I'm just really sad and I'm really broken. And then I went in these rooms and there were other people who were really sad and really broken. And it was, and it was bizarre because in the world, everyone seemed, like, really happy and together and successful and thriving. And I just kept thinking, what's wrong with me? What is wrong with me? And then I got a sponsor. Like, I finally heard someone who shared my story. And it was bizarre because I've been around a long time now. And even then, like, all the bulimics had the bulimic sponsor. And all the anorexics had the, like, anorexic sponsor. And all the compulsive overeaters had the compulsive overeater sponsor. Well, my first sponsor was a compulsive overeater sponsor. And she was like this. She was like a fire plug. And she was in the mothership program, which I wasn't in. And she was like, this is what you do. And, like, it, she was like a sergeant in the Army. And I was like, you. I want you. Because I had charmed my way out of a lot of things, and I couldn't charm my way out of bulimia and anorexia and compulsive overeating and compulsive exercising and laxative abuse and picking apart my body and, like, body does. Like, I had it all, and there was no, there didn't seem to be any way, like, my high level of charm could get me out of this. So she was like, you, this was before cell phones, people, before email, just to age myself. So I had to call her every day and tell her what I ate and what, like, and I was a compulsive liar for no reason. I'd be like, I had 2 pieces of cheese. I had 1.5. Like, I just, like if I told the exact truth, then someone would actually know me, and if they know me, they could judge me, and if they judge me, they can find out I'm broken, and if they find out I'm broken, they can reject me and tell everyone else I'm messed up. Like, my head was going. So she was the first person I got honest with. And I started going, okay, well, I actually had 2 pieces of cheese and 2 pieces of turkey. Okay. Like, and then I remember, remember reading my book, and that was just going to have me, like, underground. And she was like, oh, okay. And I was like, wait, no. I've done all this horrible stuff. You have to tell me that I'm unlovable and that I'm a piece of shit. Like, you have to tell me this. And she didn't. And that was...
I want to say that was like 25 years ago. And I have pictures of myself 25 years ago, and I look older than I do today. Like, this disease stole everything from me. And when I walked in the room, I was going to be the person. And I swore this was true. Because I'd grown up, and my mother used to say to me, you're poor, you're black, you're a woman. Life is going to be just hard for you. I mean, where do you go with that? Like, I was like, okay. So, fast forward to today. I have a lot of years of recovery. I don't throw up no matter what. Here are my bottom line answers. I don't throw up no matter what, and I don't beat myself up no matter what. I am so nice to myself. Like, because if anybody outside of my body is not nice to me, I'm like, you don't get to come in. You don't get to be a part of my life. Like, I remember I was pregnant with my first husband. I got rid of him, but he's nice. But one day he turned to me and he goes, oh, you're getting thick. I was like, wait, this is not how you talk to me. I am pregnant. Your job is to make me feel beautiful every day. And if you can't do that, we have a problem. That was the last time I heard anything that can resemble criticism during my pregnancy. He got on board, and now he's got 2 years in the beverage program. Great co-parent. But I'm a little bit of a, like I like myself. I preach about this because when I came in, I didn't. Like, I didn't like myself. I didn't love myself. I was a liar. I was like, I was sketchy. I get, like, that I lost a few friends. Today, I have long-term relationships. I'm a mother. This happened. It happened. I have a 15-year-old daughter. That happened. I love it. I love that I get to think about someone other than myself. I have 2 bonus kids from my husband, and I have a nephew whose mother passed who I get to parent. And I show up. I just took on another sponsee yesterday. It just happened. This is what happens when people say they're lonely at meetings and you invite them to lunch. You walk away being their sponsor. I don't know how it happens. But I just, like, when people come in and they want this, I so like being part of the solution. Because I feel like we're so hard on ourselves for no particular reason. And today I'm an eating disorder advocate. It's one of the things I get to do in the world. I get to go to colleges and speak to people. And I get to share my experience, strength, and hope on a global level. And it's fun because I don't have any shame. And I get to be like 50-something and in this body and in this life. And so imperfect, like perfection's not my thing. I'm not into it, so you should hear me talking to my 3 teenagers about perfection. They just think I'm crazy, but I'm like, it's okay, you'll get it. And I just love getting the opportunity to speak because I'm a different person than I was when I walked in these rooms. You know, I really thought that unless I was perfect, what I learned is if I love myself, if I don't abandon myself, everybody else gets to leave. I don't, like, I really don't care. Because at the end of the day, it's about me and my relationship with God, and it's about being of service in the world. And my biggest thing is I get to be of service in the world. Because I show up as the authentic person that I learned how to be in this program. So, thanks for letting me be of service. Have an awesome 4th of July.
Thank you so much.
All right, we're going to go ahead and bring up our speaker, Jerry. Come on up.
Good morning, everybody.
I'll hold it for you, Jerry.
But it's not out. It's going in and out.
Not on now.
It goes in and out. I hear you. Okay.
Most of you might know it. I struggle with speech. So, I resorted to writing this down. And I'm speaking mostly, solely towards newcomers and any of you who might be struggling. Since my early 20s, I had a problem keeping my weight under control. An addiction exists when a person needs to use a substance to always alleviate their anxiety in order to get through the day, whether it be food, drugs, sex, alcohol, gambling. I hit a very effective but temporary solution, engaging in or ingesting a substance that altered my mood, relieving my distress. I became dependent on this quick solution rather than experience and integrate life's difficult challenges. As a consequence, I never fully matured. I always had a frustrating family life. My parents were kids when I was born. My mother was 16 and my father was 15. At 13, my doctor suggested I lose 20 pounds, which I promptly did. During my college days, I began to lose my belief in God, but I felt very spiritual. I thought because I didn't have a higher power to lean on, that I was superior to others. I continued experimenting with fad diets. For days I would live on chicken or beef or fish or cooked vegetables. I did the grapefruit diet. I tried exercising, low calories, behavioral techniques, and psychotherapy. One doctor gave me different colored pills, very effective. I became blind for about 16 hours once and tried other diet doctors, acupuncture in my ear, hypnosis, and I kept yo-yoing until I just yo-ed. I went and signed up with a place who had a diet and supplied all the food. I failed at all these attempts. I told a therapist who rarely spoke, just listen. And I told him that I thought the only way that I could lose weight was to be tied in a straitjacket. This therapist always held his glasses like this. When I told him about the straitjacket, he looked at me and said, "That could be arranged." Frightened me. One Tuesday, I went to my OA meeting. The church antidepressants and a lipstick full of. I went in. It was very dark. One place of the room, there was a card table and a big book. I waited half an hour, and finally, after 40 minutes, I left. There was nobody there. And I was really, really pissed off. I went over to the card table, and that book turned out to be the big book. I took it, and I left. So much for being my spiritual. I found out later that I was born early. Anyway, the next night, I came to the 7:30 Wednesday night meeting at Palms Park in a wooden structure. 50, 60 people at the time. Coffee breaks, and it was a 2-hour meeting. There were people of various weights who were smiling, shaking hands, hugging. I thought there was a definite catch to it. When the seventh tradition passed, I thought it was a money-making scheme. I actually thought there was mass hypnosis. The woman speaker was fascinating and so unbelievably honest. I was memorized. I felt stunned. I disliked all the people, and I couldn't wait till the following Wednesday. I noticed the meeting starts with a prayer. I thought these people didn't waste a minute pushing the God ship. I thought, what will I do? I don't believe in God. I didn't like groups. This meeting started with a woman speaker also describing her binges, eating frozen food, stealing food, everything that I get. Most of the people with me were laughing and nodding their heads, acting like it was a long time ago. A different time of the. When I left the meeting, I got into my car with tears in my eyes. I immediately bolted to the nearest McDonald's for a hamburger and fries, or a 7-Eleven, or 2 or 3 candy bars. I felt like a loser forever. I always felt good. I had good control of my life, excepting a little food problem. My weight yo-yoed up to 326 pounds. My days were always planned, predicated on the menu each day. My vacations were planned on cities or countries by what restaurants I chose. It took me about the first 7 or 8 years in program to realize I was powerless over knowing when I could stop eating a meal. I started losing weight after I chose a sponsor. Everything seemed terrific, but I didn't work the program. I gradually started cheating on my food plan. I had forgotten that the essential characteristic that defined me as a compulsive overeater was the loss of the capacity to control my eating behavior and weight through willpower. My pink cloud had started to turn gray. I was never good at picking up the phone for help. I was giving into the impulse towards food rather than calling for OA help. The weight started going up again. I stopped going to meetings. It took me over almost 2 years. I'm losing 6 years of abstinence before I started over in the program and realized what began for me as a source of temporary relief from uncontrollable feelings had become an essential part of life. My life without the temporary relief it provides became unbearable. It was so sad to me, giving up those wonderful foods. I used to have sugar at least 3 to 6 times a day. Abstinence is necessary for me, not just because of any allergy to sugar, but because when I begin to experience this life, without resorting to quick fixes, I'm able to grow psychologically and spiritually. My present sponsor suggested I could have sugar tomorrow, but could I possibly not have it today? It sounded like a game of semantics, but I tried it. Maybe then I really had a bottom. But it gave me a chance at having a choice. This is why coming to terms with my addiction has to involve spiritual work, the essence of which is to willingness to face rather than avoid pain and suffering. By my working the 12 steps, I've had a profound psychic transformation. All I needed was the open-mindedness and willingness to investigate. In step 2, some power greater than human, some call God, could relieve a person of a condition called compulsive overeating. This is superficially a matter of excessive or under-eating. By my working step 2, I believe I'm able to develop a contact with the power within that's greater than my ego mind. In steps 3, or as with the first 2, involves an action. Step three involves making a decision. I decide to change the basis on which I've lived. The change comes through working the remaining steps. I learned after many years of writing 4th and 10th steps that I was not to find out all the negative aspects of myself, but these habits of mind could lead to unskilled ways of corresponding to my inner and outward self, deeply ingrained attitudes. As long as I kept those revenge fantasies, I always had a truck full of explosives ready towards anyone I perceived negatively towards me. And I was ready to look for food to quell the anxiety. I can't change my insides by myself. Only when I recognize my need and willingness to have a spiritual transformation with the help of my higher power. Without this inner transformation, all change for me is destined to fail. While all the times I choked off my inner self and struggled, I still kept going to meetings, thinking maybe I'll still get it. It was crucial for me to not stop going to meetings. My last 4 years were horrendous, starting with a stomach operation, and then I had arthroscopic leg operation. In and out the same day, I thought, caught a staph infection that caused the leg two more operations to clean out the infection. Had quickly operated on two discs that were squeezing my spine. That's five operations. Sorry about that. The five operations, only to find out that I needed the same neck operation set again. There was a screw loose, and then I had a stroke, and 30 days in the hospital, and 30 days in rehab. And then 9 months later, another stroke. And all that time, I've maintained my 140-pound weight loss and my abstinence 21 years. So keep coming back.